Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, Moscow activists plan coal export train protest in Sandpoint for tomorrow, and we'll hear excerpts from a University of Idaho Women's Center panel called If These Walls Could Talk, Gender Equity at the University of Idaho, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Women's Center. But first, this news. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius announced yesterday the agency will give a month-long extension to states that have not decided whether or not to accept an insurance exchange created by the federal government under the 2010 Federal Affordable Care Act. The states that haven't decided yet, including Idaho, also have the option of enacting their own health insurance exchange program. The health insurance exchange is part of Obamacare, President Obama's health insurance overhaul. In the plan, individuals will be allowed to shop for insurance through internet portals, giving them options about their insurance choices. In yesterday's announcement, Sebelius gave all the states until December 14th to make a decision to accept the federal government's help setting up the exchanges or go it alone. Today, Governor C.L. Butch Otter announced he will take the month offered by the federal government. Otter said Idaho will do the research to get answers about the program by consulting with legislative leaders. Otter said in a statement released today, quote, I have my working group's recommendations and I have been listening carefully to stakeholders and citizens about this important choice. This extension gives us more time to get answers from HHS about what the federal requirements will be. Otter's decision comes after an Idaho panel he appointed said the state should adopt a state-based exchange to broaden Idaho's Medicaid program to cover over 100,000 low-income residents. Otter set up the 15-member panel early last summer, and the recommendations came last week. Idaho was among some states hesitant to consider options about the Affordable Care Act until the election was over, saying the president's controversial legislation could have been overturned if candidate Mitt Romney won the election. Idaho's existing catastrophic health care program will spend $61 million in 2014 to cover its indigent medical bills, something panel member and Idaho Association of Counties lobbyist Dan Chadwick called financially unsustainable. Chadwick said of Idaho's current catastrophic health plan, which is funded by counties and the state, quote, it does not work. Reaction to the sentencing of Spokane police officer Carl F. Thompson Jr. continues to be varied. U.S. District Judge Fred Van Sickle sentenced Thompson to 4 years and 3 months in prison late yesterday afternoon for his role in the 2006 death of disabled janitor Otto Zem. Thompson was convicted just over a year ago of excessive force and lying to federal investigators. Thompson was the first to encounter Zem in a Division Street Zip Trip convenience store in March 2006 after Zem was wrongly accused of stealing money from a nearby teller machine. Thompson immediately started beating Zem with his ironwood baton. Police also tasered and hogtied Zem, and Zem had the weight of two police officers on top of him for several minutes. He went into a coma and died 2 days later. The 4-year, 3-month sentence was previously reported to be 4 years. Spokane's newly hired police chief, Frank Straub, told the Spokesman Review, "We daily have to make sure that we learn from this incident. This is a very different police department than it was in 2006. Straub said the department will conduct an internal investigation about other officers involved in the case and other outstanding issues related to Zem's death. Spokane Police Ombudsman Tim Burns told the paper he was comfortable with the judge's sentence. Burns is the first person to fill the ombudsman's position, which was created in part due to public concern over the killing of Zem. Burns said after sitting in on the sentencing, it was truly, for the entire city, a very sad day for Spokane, though necessary and appropriate. Mayor David Condon, first elected last year, said, our focus remains on continuing to improve public trust and confidence in the Spokane Police Department and its officers. Former Mayor Mary Verner, who lost a re-election bid to Condon but was not mayor when the incident occurred, said there needs to be a change of heart in the leadership of Spokane's police union, the Spokane Police Guild, which has blocked attempts by the city to increase police oversight by saying such changes in policy violate state collective bargaining law because they amount to a change in work conditions. Former city council member Bob Apple, who was critical of the handling of the case during his two terms on the council, said, "I just would have preferred that some of the other responsible people had also been charged." During yesterday's sentencing, trial prosecuting attorney Victor Boutrous noted Zem's last words were, "All I wanted was a Snickers," which indicated Zem had no idea why he was being attacked. Boutrous said despite Thompson's lack of criminal history until the Zem incident, quote, "Police officers are given enormous power, and that power comes with a sacred public trust. It's not okay for them to lie about their conduct. The lack of public trust is mended when they see officers being held accountable for that. It improves the credibility of the criminal justice system to know that its enforcers are not above the law." Defense attorney Carl Oriskovich said Judge Van Sickle should give Thompson credit for his long career that includes a medal for bravery in Vietnam. Oriskovich said the tragedy could not be any more significant than what he faces here today. "You live to be a certain person and how it can flip. You become the villain when all he was doing was trying to do his job." Prosecutors asked for 9 to 11 years prison time. In the end, Van Sickle cited Thompson's lifetime service to law enforcement and adjusted the sentence downward. The officers who badly beat police brutality survivor Rodney King in 1991 in Los Angeles got terms 19 months less than Thompson. Jury forewoman Diane Riley emailed the Spokesman Review after the sentence was announced, saying, "How many not-rich, non-white criminals get their sentences discounted because their co-workers found them a leader personality? I will never ever again serve on a jury, nor will I ever again have blind, naive faith in our legal system. It's rigged." Otto Zem's mother wrote a letter to the judge saying she hopes the 65-year-old Thompson is reminded daily while in prison that he has done something wrong. And Zem wrote, "He will someday be released to his family. Otto is never coming back to me." Legislative auditors say the Idaho Commission of Pardons and Parole is inefficiently managing data, which has cost the state $7.2 million since 2009. The Office of Performance Evaluation released their report Wednesday, saying commission staff has trouble managing inmate tracking data. They say the inefficiencies have gone on for more than a decade. The office says the commission's problems result in parole delays. Moscow police have started using cars with a new black and white color scheme. The Daily News reports two of the new cars hit the road Wednesday, and eventually the entire fleet of blue and white Crown Victorias will be replaced with the new Ford police interceptors at a cost of $55,000 per car. Lieutenant Paul Kwiatkowski says the police have budgeted to purchase two more of the new police cars this year. The police department plans to replace all 10 of its marked vehicles with the Ford Interceptors after each Crown Victoria has spent 5 years on the road. The Portland City Council voted unanimously Wednesday to approve a settlement with the Justice Department reforming how police deal with people with mental illness. Mayor Sam Adams negotiated the agreement with Oregon U.S. Attorney Amanda Marshall after federal investigators found Portland police engaged in a pattern of excessive force against mentally disabled people. Civil rights attorney Tom Steenson says the agreement does not go far enough because Police Chief Michael Reese defines the words immediate threat, which can allow police to use deadly force, differently than the way his police trainers interpret the words. Steenson won a major settlement on behalf of the family of Aaron Campbell, who was shot in the back and killed by police while running away. He also won a settlement for the family of James P. Chassie Jr., who died in police custody in 2006. Chassie was classified as a paranoid schizophrenic. The settlement calls for additional investigators in the police department's review division and calls for changes in use of force policies, taser use protocols, training, and oversight. National Park Service scientist Dave Halleck has reported 7 wolves wearing radio collars installed in Yellowstone National Park have been killed by hunters in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho in the last few weeks. Halleck said 5 of the wolves are from packs that den and spend most of their time in Yellowstone, and 2 are from packs that no longer spend much time inside the park. 4 were killed in Montana, 2 in Wyoming, and 1 in Idaho. Halleck says there's no indication any of the wolves were killed illegally. Wildlife advocates say there is a need for a larger buffer zone around Yellowstone in which wolves cannot be hunted. Kim Beam of Wolves of the Rockies told the Associated Press, "These animals travel and they go in and out of the park. They don't go far, but they go far enough." Beam is concerned the number of dead Yellowstone wolves could add up when Montana starts its wolf trapping season next month. Halleck says the killings won't greatly impact Yellowstone's resident wolf population, estimated to be 85 to 100 animals. He said some of the research collars, which include data that can be used by scientists, have been returned so far, and he's hoping all 7 of the collars from killed wolves will be returned to the Park Service. The Idaho Supreme Court ruled yesterday that a section of the 2008 Outdoor Sports Shooting Act, ruled unconstitutional by a lower court, is actually constitutional. The decision reverses a decision by District Judge John Mitchell, who ordered a World War II-era shooting range at Farragut State Park in the Idaho Panhandle closed because local residents reported bullets were striking their homes. Mitchell said the Sports Shooting Act amounted to a special law that cut back on judicial power. Mitchell had ordered Idaho Fish and Game, which manages the range, to improve safety and take measures to cut down on noise. After Fish and Game spent $250,000 on improvements, Mitchell ordered the range closed anyway. Fish and Game Director Virgil Moore said he is pleased with the Supreme Court decision. Moore said, "This decision will once again allow public access to Farragut Range as a safe place to practice shooting sports, sighting in firearms for hunting seasons, and firearms education and other programs." Seattle police are investigating an Election Day break-in at the state Democratic headquarters. Employees arrived at work at the Seattle office around 5:30 a.m. and found the door caved in. Another area of the office was broken into through a window leading into the director's office, where the intruders rifled through confidential files. In the report, Seattle police spokesperson Mark Jamieson wrote the burglary was something more than a routine robbery attempt. Jamieson said the burglars tried to make it appear the crime was random, but would not speculate on why the office was targeted. Jamieson said, quote, "Unless we know who the suspects are, it's kind of hard to figure out a motive." State Democratic spokesperson Benton Strong said, quote, "It's premature to make any guesses what or why it happened. We know offices were broken into and a lot of things were stolen." After securing the building, officers found ransacked offices and a trash can was dumped out and used to take out the stolen paperwork. Additionally, the thieves rifled through and moved files in the campaign office of newly elected Governor Jay Inslee and the space used by President Obama's reelection committee, Organizing for America. The thieves also broke into the offices of the Democratic media coordinator and the fundraising arm of the party. According to the report, items belonging to several workers who were of major importance to the campaigns and a laptop computer belonging to Jay Inslee's spokesperson, Jamie Smith, were stolen. Newly elected Governor Jay Inslee has chosen WSU President Elson Floyd as co-chair of his transition committee. The other co-chairs are Renton School Superintendent Mary Alice Huschel and Microsoft General Counsel Brad Smith. Inslee's senior campaign advisor, Brian Bonlander, is the transition director. Commissioners in Ada County are seeking to get back $2 million used to hire Dynamis Energy to design a waste-to-energy plant. The contract is currently under investigation by a former FBI agent. The Idaho Statesman reports the 3 commissioners voted unanimously Wednesday to exercise a clause in their contract with Dynamis, requiring Dynamis to pay back the money. The 2010 contract required Dynamis to design a 22-megawatt garbage gasifier plant. The money was funded by tipping fees at a local dump. The plan was to turn garbage into energy and would have erased the need to expand the Ada County landfill. But last week, a group of citizens filed a lawsuit against the county claiming the $2 million was a loan. The county is forbidden to give loans to businesses. Former FBI agent Verna Kessler is investigating the irregularities in a contract between local government officials and Dynamis. Dynamis did not have a representative at the commission meeting where the vote to return the money was taken. Washington's unemployment rate decreased to 8.2% in October, down from 8.5% in September. State officials said yesterday statistics show a net gain of 6,700 jobs during October. The preliminary estimate may be revised when more data comes in. While there were 2,900 less government jobs during the month, there were 9,600 more private sector jobs. Officials say an estimated 286,000 people were unemployed and looking for work in Washington in October, with 124,000 of them claiming unemployment benefits. The Whitman County Auditor's Office has asked a technician from ballot counting machine company Election Systems and Software to run tests to attempt to deal with ballot counting issues. One of the county's ballot counting machines tested was given a clean bill of accuracy. Testing also happened before the November 6th election. The machine began causing problems for election officials November 9th. It got to the point that officials had to put ballots in one at a time while there were still massive stacks of ballots left to count. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP in Moscow. We now turn to our first featured segment. Local climate change activist group Wild Idaho Rising Tide and others are planning to go to Sandpoint tomorrow to protest a planned major increase in coal train shipments through the Northwest. I spoke to Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide earlier today about the protest.
Occupy Spokane and Wild Idaho Rising Tide have gotten together to make a people's train. If you recall, the people's megalode made out of a rope outline the size of the megalodes that were about to come through Moscow. We have a cardboard replica of some of the coal trains that are going to be coming through Sandpoint, and we plan to demonstrate with that, as well as signs in opposition of this coal export scheme somewhere in a major high vehicle, high pedestrian traffic area in Sandpoint. And that's so there's carpools leaving Moscow at 8 a.m. on Saturday, November 17th. Also from the Occupy Spokane Clubhouse at 10 a.m. And then we plan to meet in the northwest corner of the Safeway parking lot up in Sandpoint by noon. And we'll probably, we don't know exactly where we're going to do our demonstration yet. It might be in a couple different places. And we'll go, you know, until it gets dark. And then after dark, we're going to do some message projection. If you got to see some of the action here in Moscow after the Dana Lyons concert back on October 19th, we just project sort of spotlighted messages up on prevalent buildings somewhere in town. We have things like coal or no coal exports and coal kills and things like that, and that's something that Occupy Spokane does. We'll do that after dark.
Tell me about the coal train issue.
Well, there right now is our opportunities to comment from the public for two different ports that are.
What's the proposal?
Well, the proposal is to ship millions and millions of tons of coal from the Powder River Basin, which is sort of in southeastern Montana and upper Wyoming, across, all the way across Montana, through some of its major cities, across the panhandle of Idaho, going around Lake Ponderay and through Sandpoint. Then it goes through a funnel down to Spokane, and then down to the Columbia River Gorge, all the way down on either the Oregon or Washington side, to four proposed ports on the West Coast. There's also a port at Boardman on the Oregon side of the Columbia River Gorge up towards us. And this coal would then be loaded, well, in the case of the Columbia River port, onto barges and then taken downriver and loaded onto ocean-going ships. In all cases, these ships are going to China so they can burn, baby, burn, and all that wonderful pollution can come back down on the Northwest coming across the ocean and also contribute significantly to climate change.
Tell me about the scale of this project. It sounds like coal gets exported all the time or has been in the last decades. What's different this time?
Well, they're in a big hurry to get it out of here. It's the kind of coal that they can't, under environmental regulations, burn in the United States. I believe it's high sulfur coal. And so they're shipping it off to China, mostly in advance of China developing its own resources way up in its western mountains. It would take them about 6-7 years to get up there and build the infrastructure. So they're trying to sell this to China. But the whole world is trying to sell their coal to China right now.
How many trains?
Well, right now we understand there's maybe only a half dozen top-end trains that are already going all along this whole path, which I didn't finish. It goes up, you know, north from the gorge through the very populous Puget Sound. Now it goes to a port right outside of Vancouver, B.C., those trains do, but there could be an additional 40 to 60 trains per day. It works out to a couple trains every single hour.
So health impacts are a concern?
A real big concern. Not only do coal trains spew lots of coal dust, especially in the first 100 miles, but if you look along any train tracks, you'll see coal dust everywhere. They also spew diesel fumes. They're noisy. They'll block traffic. They'll block emergency services, just like we saw with the megaloads. And that's going to put a powerful dent on local businesses and regional economies. There's also concerns, of course, for the increased possibility of derailments, of wearing down the track, since coal trains are very, very heavy, 125 cars, and you know that other substances that are more hazardous going through could possibly derail and spill with coal wearing down tracks.
How many trains a day would go through Sandpoint and Spokane, which, from what I understand, is the bottleneck on the route from the Powder River coal basin in Wyoming and eastern Montana to these various Pacific ports?
We've heard as many as 60 a day, 40 to 60 today. And there are about three stretches all along those tracks where there's only one set of tracks.
And these would be mile-long trains, or how long?
Yeah, they're about a mile and a half. They have about 125 cars, and each car sheds 1 pound of coal dust per mile. So that's a lot of coal dust going into the air.
And this protest in Sandpoint, is it mainly a way to raise awareness among the citizens of Sandpoint about this issue?
Well, they've already been pretty well mobilized from what we understand by the Lake Pend'Oreille Waterkeeper. We're just looking for other folks who'd like to do direct action with us and also trying to get people to the hearings. There's actually two hearings we just found out this week that are on the same night. They must. I don't know if the states are not talking to each other or to the feds or what, but on December 4th, there's a hearing for the port they want to build in Boardman. There's also a hearing, and that's in Boardman. In that hearing, there's another hearing in Spokane for the port they want to build near Bellingham, and these are the closest opportunities for everybody in Montana and Idaho and eastern Washington to have their say orally and physically to both the federal government and the state departments that are facilitating, from what we can tell, these ports going through. And so it is absolutely crucial that Idahoans and Montanans and eastern Washingtonians show up at these hearings, because most opponents of these ports argue that there needs to be a programmatic EIS, some kind of environmental review that considers the entire scope of impacts from this coal export scheme, which is going to, of course, impact everybody from the mines to the ports. And so if the people in the far-flung area from the ports show up, then it could possibly force them to do a more rigorous environmental review and set the clock back.
So if people from Moscow want to carpool with Wild Idaho Rising Tide up to the Sandpoint protest tomorrow, where do they meet?
Well, you can check out our website, you can check out our Facebook page, and give us a call or email us. And we're actually meeting at the Wild Idaho Rising Tide Activist House, and we can tell you where that's at if you get a hold of us.
But it's early in the morning.
Yep, 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning.
That was Helen Yost of the Moscow-based group Wild Idaho Rising Tide. Yost is encouraging activists to write to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality asking the agency to postpone the Boardman hearing because it is taking place on the same night as the Spokane coal train hearing. The Spokane hearing, put on by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Washington Department of Ecology, will be held at the Spokane County Fairgrounds Plaza Tuesday, December 4th from 4 to 7 p.m. The address there is 404 North Havana Street. The Boardman, Oregon hearing is scheduled to start at 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 4th at the Port of Morrow, 2 Marine Drive in Boardman, Oregon. We now turn to our second featured segment. As part of the University of Idaho Women's Center's 40th anniversary celebration, the Women's Center sponsored a panel discussion with some of the women involved in the formation and history of the center. Here is one of the panelists, Council for Advancement and Support of Education member Barbara Petura, who was the vice president of university communications when the Women's Center was formed in the early 1970s. This was recorded September 26th.
The journey for gender equity at the University of Idaho in the early 1970s had its roots, and now you have to kind of take your history hat here, in 1848, the deep roots in Seneca Falls, New York, which was the location for the first women's rights convention. And it was there that women finally said publicly and passed declarations of the need for women's rights that began the long struggle that we continue to work on today. So that was the beginning. Then for the next 72 years, courageous women fought for the right to vote. And again, we tend to take it for granted, but that was finally passed and achieved on August 26, 1920, when the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was signed. So in the early 70s, we were taking, you know, that right to vote for granted, and yet we knew that there was more to do. The next key influence on the journey toward human rights for women in America really was part of the overall civil rights movement in America from 1955 through the 1960s. This was a fight for equality for people of all races, religions, and national origins. And it was an era of really profound change. Those of us who lived through it or have read about it or seen the films, you know what it was all about. The key steps for women sometimes get buried in that history, but they were profound. And it's worth listing them just to keep thinking about what that context is. 1961, President John Kennedy established the President's Commission on the Status of Women for the country and appointed Eleanor Roosevelt as chairwoman. And they found substantial discrimination against women in the workplace and recommended, now you're going to gasp, such things as fair hiring practices, paid maternity leave, and affordable child care. So it kind of, that was, you know, quite a few years ago. So half a century ago, in fact. So that's important to keep that. We're still working on issues. 1963, Betty Friedan published her bestseller, The Feminine Mystique. If you haven't read it, you must. That described women's dissatisfaction with the narrow role that was imposed on them by society at the time. On June 10th of that year, Congress passed the Equal Pay Act that made it illegal for employers to pay a woman less than what a man would receive for the same job. Up until then, that's just perfectly fine, and of course, we all kind of think it still goes on, but it's at least illegal, and you can sue about it. 1964, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act barred discrimination in employment on the basis of race and sex. That was really important that gender or sex was included in that, and it was more than race. And then the Equal Opportunity Commission was appointed to investigate complaints and impose penalties. And I'm doing this to give you the shape of what was going on in the country as we get into what happened here in the early 70s. Then in 1972, the Equal Rights Amendment passed Congress and sent to the states. Of course, it was never finally ratified, but there was the attempt. 1972, the very year we're going to talk about. And Title IX of the Education Amendments barred sex discrimination in schools. So the tide, the journey is leading us to what was going on across America. And right here in Idaho, women too wanted to see improvements in education and in the workplace and more, and they wanted to see change happen now. It was at that precise time, 1972, that University of Idaho President Ernest Hartung appointed a committee to study the high attrition rate of women students. Women students would come, but they were dropping out in much greater numbers than men. And there was a desire to know why and what could be done about it. And about 35% of students at the time were women. So what was going on? Dean A. Jean Hill, who was the head of Student Advisory Services, chaired the committee. Included faculty such as El Negron, the well-known Virginia Woolf, for whom the award is named, and others. And they took the core process and added such issues as the numbers of women in the various faculty ranks and pay scales for women faculty and staff, issues that I would argue are probably still very relevant today, but big stabs were taken at the problem, which was very severe at the time. So the committee's findings were published in what many people would say today is the University of Idaho's first campus climate report. And people that were interested in it began to learn about it, come together and have discussions. And actually, that committee opened itself up to others that were interested. And they were meeting with President Hartung and Vice President Robert Coonrod, Academic Vice President Coonrod. Well, I was among the people who became very interested in what was going on. I was 30 years old. I had recently been promoted to manager of the news bureau here at the university. And I had always believed in equal opportunity for women. I read and been inspired by the feminine mystique. My grandmothers and my mother were college educated and teachers, and I was always encouraged to develop and use my talents. So I was just poised to get myself involved in something that, looking back, was probably pretty darn amazing that that small group of us that signed the complaint actually did. Of course, we had the really critical leadership of Jean Hill and Ginny Wolf, who were in positions. Ginny was a tenured faculty member, I believe, and Jean was, you know, at a high enough level that they could take on the risk of leading us in the core caucus group. The other thing that was so important, I don't believe any of it would have happened without Ernest Hartung as president. He met with us regularly, he heard the issues, and he finally said to us, as president, I can't wave a magic wand and make all the changes happen that you want. Even without a magic wand, I can only make little steps forward. If you feel you need to make a complaint to the Human Rights Commission, which itself was quite young in the state of Idaho, he said, I will make sure that you face no retaliation, because we could benefit by the push that would come from outside the institution to know that these are really important issues. So essentially, that's what happened. In May of 1973, the core caucus did file the complaint with the Idaho Human Rights Commission and the EEOC. And there were eight of us, as I recall, seven women and one man, Leo Ames. And it began to go from there. There was never any desire to hurt the university. We simply believed that the time was right then, to make strides for women, women students, women faculty, women staff, and that's what we did. So fortunately, we were able not to have these go to court, of course, but to go into a settlement, and President Hartung and the core caucus signed the conciliation agreement on May 8th of 1974. And that agreement is really how we linked to the Women's Center, because there were a series of things the University of Idaho said, we will do to settle this complaint and that is the conciliation agreement is still in effect today. And it's a powerful force for all of the work to continue for women. And some of the things that were involved were the creation of an affirmative action officer, an affirmative action plan, the Women's Center director position, job analysis, back pay, equal starting salaries, and on and on. And I then had a chance actually to chair the faculty salary committee, which looking back again is pretty amazing that I was trusted to chair this. But there were, you know, obviously faculty and staff on it. But we compared equals peers to peers, women faculty members, say an assistant professor in English with a male assistant professor in English who'd been here about comparable length of time, comparable publications, and looked at salaries. And if the salaries were clearly unequal, we would recommend bringing the salaries up. And so back pay was, in fact, one of the things that was achieved. So it was an amazing time of ferment. I think without question, the Women's Center is most likely the single most lasting legacy in terms of a permanent structure that makes programs and interaction with students possible. Surely the improvement in the status of women faculty and staff has occurred, and I think the enrollment of students is now inching toward 50%, right? 45, 47? I know you're going to give us an update on that. And of course, nationally, that's, you know, women are doing very well at getting their college educations.
That was Council for Advancement and Support of Education member Barbara Petura, who was the Vice President of University Communications when the University of Idaho Women's Center was formed in the early 1970s. She was speaking on a panel celebrating the 40th anniversary of the UI Women's Center held at the UI Commons September 26th. Yin radio host Virginia Solon recorded the panel for KRFP. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the Radio Free Moscow website at krfp.org or radiofreemoscow.com to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow and to become a member. Jim Roach and Craig Wheeler assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great weekend.